Yes, PLG is not free trial. Let me start by saying that. A lot of people go, we have a free trial, therefore we're PLG. This is so important. Like, if you only take away one thing from this podcast, PLG is not free trial. And it really has to do, again, with positioning. And so you can't position a product if you don't know what segment you're going after. So
hey everyone, welcome to the Product Marketing Life podcast, the show where we sit down with everyday product marketers to talk life, career, and most importantly, product marketing. Today, I had the chance to sit down with one of my product marketing icons, and dare I say, the queen of PLG herself, Madison Leonard. And I really enjoyed this conversation. We chatted through some of the mistakes that product marketers make in segmentation, how companies can become more product-led and what it even means to be product-led, and why features don't make a product number one. I loved this conversation. I think you will too. Enjoy the episode. Madison, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. You're such a cool friend. So I'm ready to like dive into all of this with you.
I feel really grateful. As soon as I was asked to start hosting, I started forming my short list of like, all right, who are the first couple people I'm going to ask? And you were immediately on the short list. So It feels really exciting to actually have you on.
Oh my gosh, this is so exciting then.
When I think of you, so aside from all the like PLG and go-to-market work that you've been doing, I think of a couple things, and some of these might be shared with others. One is your iconic glasses. Love your specs. I remember when we met at the SF Summit, that was part of how my brain transitioned from, oh, this is a person I know online, to, oh, it's Madison standing in front of me, was that you wearing your glasses. So they're a part of your brand at this point.
They are. So I've accepted it.
Second, that you live in Orange County. So I grew up in Orange County. And every time you post like a casual hiking photo, I just feel sadness, envy, and happiness for you. Because remind me, where are you in Orange County?
So I'm in Huntington Beach.
Oh, you poor thing.
And I know. Everyone's like, oh, you live in Orange County. You must live in like, I don't know, Newport or Corona Del Mar or something, you know, very Orange County. And I'm like, I live in Huntington Beach. And they're like, oh, okay.
No, Huntington's great. I mean, when I grew up, Costa Mesa wasn't cool when I grew up in Orange County. And now it's gotten so bougie.
Yes.
It crossed the threshold. It went from being cool and kind of niche to where now it just feels like, I don't know, I might have to pay money to use the restroom somewhere. Or, you know, definitely. It feels like everything feels expensive. Like I can't sneeze without paying money. But yes. I feel like Huntington still has a little bit of that like classic beach Americana feel of Orange County. Yes. I think Huntington has it. I think San Clemente still has it a little bit.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And basically everything in between has changed.
I agree. That's why I like Huntington so much, is because I'm like close enough to where I could go in. I can like explore, you know, some of the bougie parts, even like go to Laguna Beach, which has the awesome hikes and all of that kind of stuff, farmers markets, but I'm not like in it. I'm not living in it. I still feel like I live in a really like down to earth type of place, and I still have my Whole Foods, and I still have, you know, I can go to the nearest whatever, like spin class. That's really cool in Newport Beach, but I'm not like living in that every day where you're seeing like, you know, just, you understand.
I get it, for sure. You get all the luxuries of Orange County without snobbiness of.
Yes, that's exactly.
And I can say it because I grew up there. So anyone who's offended in Orange County, know that I love you and envy you.
Newporters being like.
I know. All those Costa Mesa product marketers shaking their fists.
I know.
If they can afford to live there. And then the third thing that I think of is, you might not remember this, but it's probably about two years ago. I had just gotten laid off from a product marketing role, and I'd probably been following you for a little while at that point. And one way or another, a post of yours ended up in my feed where you had opened up just free for all. If anyone wants, any product marketers want feedback on their resume, that you were giving out resume feedback. I don't know if you remember this, but I quickly took you up on it because I'm on the job hunt, didn't have as much of experience as I would like trying to compete. And I remember it was so fast. Within a couple minutes, I sent you my resume and I got a message back from you where you had fired up Loom and you were just narrating, walking through my resume. And it was one, wildly helpful, but two, I actually have some of those changes are still in my resume in its current form. And I've recommended them to others. Like there's little tweaks that you made for like, oh, I would cut this, don't include that, add this. So all that to say, one of my first impressions of you was just you being kind and generous with your time. And I think that, you know,
that is so sweet.
People, I mean it for real. Like people will talk accolades of, oh, Madison built ClickUp into a category leader, which is of note. And we can talk about it in a second. But I do think it's worth just saying that you're a kind person and people don't always know that through a sea of LinkedIn posts and thought leadership and that sort of thing. So again, good to have you on.
Oh my gosh. Wow. You've caught me off guard. I don't even know what to say with that story, but yeah, I am glad that that is at least something that's coming across. Cause I try really hard to like open up my calendar or do other things on LinkedIn. Cause I feel like a quick side note, I have done this for other people, whether it was on LinkedIn or other things. And someone that I like, you know, really look up, this has happened recently, look up to and respect. And I've like reached out and like even followed up or like, you know, various things and I won't get a response from them. And it's so disheartening. And I hated that feeling. And so like, I don't do as great of a job of it because sometimes my inbox can be really overwhelming, but I really do try to like make connections here rather than like, I don't want to be this person that's just like posting random crap and like never talking to anyone. I just don't think that's helpful to the community. And like the reason that I started posting on LinkedIn was because this was at a time, now everybody's posting on LinkedIn, but this was at a time where there wasn't a whole lot of people posting on LinkedIn and especially not about product marketing. Everything about product marketing, I had to learn the hard way on my own, including like what to include on a resume all the way to like what is the best, you know, positioning and messaging framework. And a lot of the stuff that I found online just was, I don't know, content jargon. It wasn't like all that helpful. So I wanted to post on LinkedIn to not only help the community as a whole is like why I started posting, helping in terms of content, but also helping in terms of like, I want to help people land jobs or move jobs or find out if product marketing is for them or whatever it means. So I'm so touched that was actually impactful because sometimes I worry that I'm not doing enough of that. So
no, you're doing plenty. And yeah, it's hard to keep up. Even with my like modest following, I get DMs and I always want to give as much as I possibly can. But
yes,
I think part of why I'm motivated to give is because I've had people like you and others who have gone out of their way and taken time. So thanks for that. It's appreciated. Oh my gosh. Now, I mentioned a little bit of your history, but you're currently running a go-to-market consultancy with SaaS Secrets. Mm-hmm. And I feel like everyone in the product marketing world should already know who you are. But if they don't, could you give just like a little bit of a context of what your product marketing journey has looked like up to this point?
Yeah. So I actually started in product. A lot of people don't know that, but I worked at DreamWorks Animation. I grew up in LA. Okay. So for context, super duper context, I grew up in LA. And when you grow up in LA, you think you're going into the entertainment industry because that's what everybody does. That is the capital of LA. So you think you're going to go into something there. That's what everybody does here. So I went to DreamWorks Animation, but I got really lucky in that I didn't work in their like animation studio. They had pivoted and done this like hub on the campus for a direct consumer mobile app. This was way before the time of like Snapchat and all the other video platforms. And it was like a video sharing platform for, you know, friends and family and whatever. And I just got lucky. And so I was in this like startup, but it was again, like well-funded because it was within DreamWorks Animation. Yeah. So it was a small scrappy team, well-funded. It was just the perfect world of everything. And I was working on user experience side of things more on the product end. And I loved it. And you got to remember from entertainment, you work on something for 2+ years before it goes live. And the minute you launch it, there's no changing it. There's no take backs. Like everything you've done is there. And then all of a sudden now I'm in this world of tech where nothing's real. I mean, like in a sense, you could change everything if you wanted to. Literally in the snap of a finger. And so I just was like so fascinated by that. And when I was in there, I saw what marketing was doing and I was like, oh, that seems really cool. And everybody was gathering around and being like, all right, launch, launch, launch. And I was like, gosh, this seems so fun. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to pivot. I'm going to go into marketing. I went and tried a bunch of different things in marketing. And so I definitely have a generalist background of marketing where I've done content, social media, I've done paid, like everything. And then eventually all of my friends did specialist in other things and I never felt tied to one. And again, this is before product marketing really was like well known. And then I eventually went and led generalist marketing for a portfolio investment company. And during my time there, I just literally was, because it was a, like portfolio company, it was launching products literally all the time. Like I just honed the skill of launch, go to market. And being like really, really efficient within that because we didn't have just one product we were working on. Then all of a sudden, product marketing started to become a thing. And, you know, I saw articles being written about it and I was like, oh my gosh, this is like what I do. I'm not doing these like one or two things. Let me add that to what I'm doing. And like product marketing is what I've been doing for all this time. And so after a while doing that, ClickUp called and they were basically like, they had been looking for a product marketer for a while. And every product marketer that they had come across only had like sales enablement type experience. And so because I came from the direct consumer world and I dabbled in a little B2B stuff, but primarily like 80% of my work was really focused on direct to consumer. And then direct to consumer land, if you don't have people using your product and liking it, you don't have a business. And lo and behold, I come into, you know, B2B. And as I'm sort of learning the world of B2B in more depth, that's not always the case in B2B. You could definitely have a product that people don't like. You could have
like five customers.
Yeah. And you are, you know, you're fine. And that's the other thing too. You could have 200 customers and have millions in revenue. And it's just mind-boggling to me. So anyway, I come over into this B2B world and they were looking for someone who had direct to consumer experience because they were PLG. They had a freemium. And so they needed someone who was very, very close with product and being able to do launches at a consumer level as well as, you know, at more of an enterprise level. So I was there for 2 years, joined as the first product marketer, you know, built processes and the team and all of that kind of stuff from the ground up. And then eventually went on to do fun PLG thing at Vanta, where we launched like a new free trial type of product. And then after that, I kind of was like, you know what? I really like doing this like consulting advising thing. So I'm going to continue doing that and see where it goes. And it's been like, I think almost a year and a half now that I've done that, which is crazy. And so I do everything from like fractional work, doing like interim stints, getting product marketing foundations and teams up and running, mostly for like early stage or growth stage companies. So that's where I am today.
Yeah. But all with that kind of go-to-market lens, like that's the thread that runs through.
Yes.
Why companies are reaching out to you.
Yes. So this is a lesson that I learned early on is like launch and go-to-market strategy are very different and yet they're talked about so similarly. And so I'm really trying to like break through the noise on this one. Launch, you could launch something and it not be a viable product. Like if you launch a beta, you're testing if that beta is working or not. You don't need a whole go-to-market strategy. Like this is not a big thing that's happening. And vice versa, go-to-market strategy is not always launch. Like you could have a go-to-market strategy for a segment. You know, if you have three segments you're going after, you could have a go-to-market strategy for how you're going to acquire, activate, retain, and monetize that segment. And you as a product marketer have to take this like cadence picture and this positioning picture and help to formulate it into this go-to-market strategy for this segment and pick out what things are relevant to them from both a product perspective as well as like a content thought leadership perspective. So I really like, you know, go-to-market strategy over launch. I know that's maybe a little controversial, but that's my personal take because I think it's more impactful to the bottom line of the business more so than anything else.
I'm in the same boat in that I think I get more excited about go-to-market, partially because if it's long tail. I mean, there's a lot of talk about having like a rolling thunder launch, and that's important for sure. You can stretch out the longevity of it and that's going to increase how many people adopt it. And the two can't be perfectly split out because a lot of times your go-to-market is wrapped around a launch. Like we're launching this new thing and that's shifting it. But I tend to agree that I think that there's a lot of go-to-market has to do with finding opportunities and seeing and being able to scan the market and seeing where can we fit in and win. And that isn't always contingent on launching a new product. A lot of times it's, this is what we have and we need to find a way to win. And this is the little market or corner of the world that we can win in.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I wish you could just like frame that and put it like in my office, because what you just said was like, I'm serious. It's so undervalued. Like, people do not think that way. And it seems so obvious, but people don't think that way. And I think oftentimes, especially in SaaS, because nothing is finished, like we talked about earlier, you can launch forever, like literally forever, and tweak and all these things, that I think sometimes as product marketers, we have to push the brake a little bit and say, I love that we have all these launches coming up, but our customers, our target segment, they don't know about this whole slew of launches that you did prior to a product marketer, or like whatever it may be. And so doing the go-to-market from more of this high-level lens, and when you take it away from launch, now it's more perspective to the entire platform and the offerings that are relevant, even, and not at all about the roadmap. I mean, yes, the roadmap's cool, don't get me wrong, but like, it's about what you have and what value you deliver today. So yes, I wish I could frame what you said.
That's helpful. I feel like I stumbled into that in my last role, because we were at I was at a startup that had a really firm hold in the Australian market, but was trying to break into the US market, and no one really knew them. Mm-hmm. And we had all these features that were getting shipped for what I would say is like our secondary product. And it felt like it was breaking some sort of product marketing rule when I said, hey, we're not even going to give those any market attention, because for the next 5 months, we just need to say, this is what our core product does in this market, and we need to take it to this market. And so it's going to be features that they get a release note, they get a customer email, and beyond that, that's it. Like, we're just not going to give them attention, because no one knows what the hell our main product does, and we need to break into this market.
Oh my gosh. Yes. And I, the other thing that I'll add to that too, I don't know if you ever get any like founders listening to this, at all, but I'll say it anyway, just in case there's like one, founders, especially technical founders, are very excited about technology. They are very much the like visionary adopters and sort of the like adopter scale. Most people are not like that. And so I think that this is a really big lesson that I end up having to like share with these like technical founders, is like, you get excited, and there are other people like you, but it's a very small percentage of the population. Uh-huh. You get excited by new tech. If you see an article written by TechCrunch about some new wave of whatever, you're opening and you're reading it. This is not the majority of people. And so it's not about the newest and the latest. It's actually just about solving a problem and like getting back down into that reality. And that's how you go to market and win in larger audiences as well. So yes, I agree with you.
You just got to recognize you're the weirdo. It's like the founders can be self-aware and know you're the weirdo. Your customer doesn't think that same way.
Yes.
It kind of reminds me of, it's funny, I had Anthony Piri on recently, and we kind of beat up on Simon Sinek and his whole start with the why thing. But I think, because people just want to know your what sometimes.
Yeah.
But I think he has another, I could be misquoting this, but he also talks about how most of the time, most leaders under-communicate by a factor of 10. Mm. And I think that's true in marketing a lot of times too, is we want to talk about what's new and what's exciting. But a lot of times there's just, we've under-communicated our main product, what it solves, its competitive differentiator. And we probably need to say that 5 more times just for it to start getting into people's heads.
Yes.
And so I'm very much with you. You know, this is super related to, I did a little LinkedIn perusing preparing for this interview.
As
like
one does.
Like a good, yeah, as one does. And you had this, and you had this header image, you had a quote that stood out to me. You wrote that you help startups, quote, develop go-to-market strategies so good that if their competitors copied their exact feature set tomorrow, they would still be number one. And I like this because, one, it's tied to what we're talking about, but there's this underlying point of view here that features are not necessarily what makes a product number one in its category. And that might be shocking to some people, but I feel like I see this type of obsession with in product teams about this. This obsession with feature parity, this worry that other competitors will copy your features, this gatekeeping of product information to try to keep that from happening. And it's kind of a mess. Can you unpack your thinking on why features are not what makes a product number one?
Yes. So I actually learned this at ClickUp because when you talk with people, everyone's like, oh, you're just another project management tool, right? That's the gist, right? Oh, you're like XYZ. They list all the competitors.
You're like,
right?
Asana. You're like Jira. Yeah.
Exactly. And then, you know, for a while in the beginning, I was like, oh, but we're so much more, which to be fair is true. Like, that's not inaccurate. However, it was so focused on what the features were, what the platform did, all of these things. In talking with more customers, what I realized was they actually just need, they just need a Toyota is what I call it. And I asked this in my customer interviews, like what brand of car would you associate with, you know, XYZ? And I asked this, especially if they're using a competitor and they want to come over, whatever. Every single time it's the same. They either say Toyota or Subaru. That's it. Because people just want their problem to be solved. They need it to be intuitive, right? And they need their problem to be solved. And that's about it. They don't really care that you have all of these, like this laundry list of other features. Yeah. It actually only matters if it's helping them solve this problem. And so it's high level, more about the problem and solution oriented type of thing. However, the other thing that I really learned was that brand plays such an integral role in why people make decisions. I think now B2B SaaS is starting to catch up to this a little bit, but it's still very early stage. Like, there are so many instances of companies who have done so well with branding and their product is good. It's not like the product is bad. It just is, the product is good. It does what it is meant to do. And that's it. There's no other bells and whistles. It's just meeting the market expectation. And it has an amazing brand. And that branding piece and the positioning piece, I'm kind of putting together brand and product marketing. I know that may be a little controversial, but in B2B SaaS, I think
they're related.
Yeah, related.
B2B, yeah.
Yes. So, you know, positioning from both a brand and product perspective, you know, putting content out that's iterating a similar narrative and having an overall brand vibe, I'm going to call it, like just the thing that kind of makes a company, you know, because people make decisions with their emotions. This has been proven time and time again. People make decisions based on emotions. And so whatever you are communicating to the market, and by the way, also what your salespeople are communicating, and just every single touch point with a brand, from an email to talking with someone to seeing some YouTube ad that popped up for them, everything is communicating that. And it's so much bigger than just the feature set. And I think a lot of the times, like we were talking about earlier, especially technical founders, because they're so technically minded and get so excited about that, that's initially what they go to market with. And that works in the beginning because you are acquiring the same people, but it doesn't scale. It doesn't scale to the mass market. And so it's really about trying to hone in on what is your positioning, what is the narrative you want to get across, and also what is this bigger pain and problem that you're solving. And it's not always about the newest, shiniest feature that you have to do that.
Yeah. It feels very much in line with crossing the chasm, just that concept. Yes. That early on you adopt, the people who are adopting your product are those who are not risk adverse. They're very comfortable with risk and they're just there for the tech. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, once you've conquered that segment, you get to the segment that is very much risk adverse and they want the Toyota. They want the reliability. Yep. They want it to do the core things that it's meant to do. And they'll take or leave whether it has this feature or that feature. Mm-hmm. I almost wonder when it comes to launching products like that and even knowing, hey, we don't have this feature that a competitor has. I wonder how much of that, and maybe you could speak to this if you had to do this at ClickUp, do you have to define what the core functionality should be for your category? Like, is there having to almost put language to that? Because I would imagine someone would come to a project management tool and they might not even know what are the core things I should be looking for and what matters to me, rather than just, I don't know, having a list of Harvey balls that they can say, it has all these different features. Do you have to kind of put language to a customer's desire of like, these are the main features you're looking for. These are the ones that matter. And we happen to have them.
Yeah. I think that this is really going back to the like problem solution type of thing, because a lot of people, if they've never used a project management tool before, which by the way, this is like common in any B2B industry that you go into, you're usually not fighting against your competitors. You're fighting against the status quo, and you're fighting against, you know, no decisions. Those are the two biggest competitors in a sales cycle. And even just with PLG too, that's the biggest competitors. It's not actually your competitors. And so keeping that in mind, people usually aren't, you sometimes get these people, but majority of the time, people aren't like going to each tool and like trying each one out and being like, I have the exact thing that I'm looking for, right? That doesn't happen unless someone is very, very late in the cycle. This is not someone just coming into the cycle, just trying your product right now. So it's more about solving the problem. So it's not about, hey, I need a project management tool that allows me to do subtasks in other lists. Like a lot of people won't even know what that is. I only know what that is because I worked at ClickUp. Like I had no idea what that was before, right?
And it's such a, I still haven't figured out subtasks.
Yes, exactly. So it's like, you know, when people are working in spreadsheets, or maybe they're not even working in spreadsheets, they're just working on Slack. And, you know, this is no doubt to tout, you know, to spreadsheets or Slack, like they're amazing tools and they're not to be replaced. But there are certain things that are just base level, like, hey, I need to communicate XYZ across the org in a more efficient way, or I need to keep track of everything that I'm doing in one place, or I need to work cross-functionally. This happens to me all the time. I need to work cross-functionally. I don't need a tool that's just for marketers. I need a tool that is across everyone. And now it becomes less about features and it's more about the job to be done, like what actually is there. And then I think it's the sales job. I mean, technically, it's the product marketing's job to inform sales on like how to communicate the narrative of all of this. But it's about coming up with, okay, these are the pains, these are the solutions that we provide, and here are all the features that ladder up into it. And now here's where like rubber meets the road a little bit, where now you can talk about features, but it's within context. The context is really important because no one cares that you added subtasks and multiple lists and it makes it more efficient for XYZ, you could talk about it all day and it's not relevant to people. So that relevancy and that context is really where the magic happens.
That's good. You talked a minute ago about segmentation and it ties into this post you did a while back. You recently wrote a post comparing Venmo and PayPal. And the two, if you just look at the feature set objectively, they have a very similar core feature set. You send and receive money. That's what PayPal and Venmo both accomplish that. But they have wildly different go-to-markets. And even as people relate to them, they relate to them very differently, in part to the choices they made around segmentation. Could you speak a little bit to what most go-to-market teams, whether they're clients you're working for or just ones you've been a part of, tend to get wrong or miss when it comes to segmentation and thinking about segmentation?
I would say the first and foremost, the most obvious is they don't do segmentation. Like they, I think that, no, truthfully, it sounds so silly, but like they go, we're for everyone. And I think it's really easy to say we're for everyone and think of all of these really big products that are for everyone, like Apple or whatever. And they forget that like Samsung, I think Samsung actually just passed Apple in total sales. I think this is like a good thing. Yes. So who knows? Maybe this is the downfall of Apple. But in general, like there is still deep segmentation, even at these really large companies. And so I like doing examples of like Venmo and PayPal because arguably they are huge. A lot of people not only know who they are, but use them, but they use them for different things. And I think people don't understand how they could be pulled to one versus the other. And it really has to do again with positioning. And so you can't position a product if you don't know what segment you're going after. So for Venmo in particular, they wanted to go after the younger audience and they wanted it to be more about sending and receiving money from friends and family and colleagues and things like that. And it wasn't really business oriented, whereas PayPal really took the business approach. And so everything in terms of the branding, the intuitiveness, the feature set on a more granular level, everything ladders back up into that segment. And so a lot of the times when I work with founders and early teams, this is one of the first questions that I ask is like, who are you going after? And they'll just say something generic. Like even if it's still one team. Exactly. Yes. We're going after salespeople. I'm like, okay, there's a lot of salespeople. Who in sales are you going after? Why? What problem are you like getting really clear on those foundational elements is what makes or breaks a company's trajectory, because you can be a wildly successful company if you know who your core segment is, and everything else follows from the branding to the feature set that you're going to include, the roadmap you have, the intuitiveness, whether it's a freemium, free trial, reverse trial, or closed, whether like whatever it is, segment will be your treasure chest that like unlocks all of that for you.
Yeah. That's a helpful, I mean, just even your simple line in there that you can't position without having your segment clear.
You can't.
That's a helpful starting point. Cause I think I tend to start with what are we capable of?
Yeah.
And I look at what our product is capable of and kind of back into, okay, well, this is where we're unique. And then, well, that particular thing that we are unique in, and I'm already halfway to building positioning at this point, matters to these people. And so, all right, let's then craft messaging to reinforce positioning based on these feature sets to this person. And I'm kind of hearing you almost starting and backing. I mean, and obviously it's not a cut and dry science. Like the features do play into that a little bit, but that's a really helpful orientation of thinking about the very specific segment you want to go to and then working backwards into your positioning.
And that's an ideal world. I would say 99% of product marketers I talk with don't operate in the ideal world. It's usually like, you know, not that way, which is fine. You know, I think that this is why I'm so interested in that like chasm area of crossing over from early stage to growth stage, because early stage is all about early product market fit. And it's not necessarily about talking to the masses. And it's a product marketer's job to figure out how to do that. And so you do have to work backwards sometimes and be like, well, what's working today? And it'll help you back into the segment that you're currently serving. And you don't necessarily need to do upfront work in the beginning on that. But yeah, I mean, eventually you cannot position correctly. You're right. Without knowing the segment.
Yeah. And sometimes I find that even some of the best segmentation can come out of just looking at your current audience and looking at your current customer base and saying, who are we killing it with?
Yes.
And let's just pour more gas on that, because we kind of stumbled into this little segment that loves us.
Totally.
You know, thinking about Venmo and PayPal, one of the things that made Venmo great in my mind is the way that they cracked not just segmentation, but product-led growth. They just, they found ways to kind of build in. I know it's kind of a sexy thing to say, but like these like viral growth loops, like they've really nailed that PLG motion. Mm-hmm. And I always think of you as one of the leading voices on PLG, whether you would self-identify as that or not. So just for the sake of clarity, I think it gets thrown around a lot. How are you defining PLG?
Oh, thank you for asking this question, because it needs to be answered every time.
Please answer it for us.
Yes. PLG is not free trial. Let me start by saying that. A lot of people go, we have a free trial, therefore we're PLG. And that is not the case.
Product-led growth. What people can't see is your emphasis with your hands. Like, PLG is not free trial.
Everybody listen.
The hands are in motion with every word.
This is so important. Like, if you only take away one thing from this podcast, PLG is not free trial. PLG, product-led growth, is what it stands for, is where the product is the vehicle for growth in your company. It doesn't mean that you don't grow from sales. It doesn't mean you don't grow from marketing. It just means that the product is a major player in growth for your company. And so in order for product to lead that growth in some way in capacity, most of the time you need some kind of free trial, freemium, reverse trial, whatever it is, because otherwise you can't do that. But that is just sort of the what. It's not like it doesn't add up to what PLG is. So when you have a PLG model that works really well, you have an ability for someone to share the product, for the person that they shared it with to come into the product, to try it out. Then you need to get to what's called activation, which is essentially just the aha moment in the platform, which means you have to know what the aha moment is the platform. And this may be different for each of the different segments, right, that you have. And then you need to, you know, have an onboarding flow that gets them to that aha moment as fast as possible, because we have short attention spans today and we need it now. And then also get to retention. And then later on, you get to finally monetization. And that's where product is not only the acquisition vehicle, but also can have this self-serve like monetization strategy as well. So I could talk about this for a really long time. That's the cut and dry version of PLG. And I'm glad you asked it, because a lot of people think it's just free trial, where that is just sort of the vehicle that makes it happen. But if you have a free trial and you don't have, you know, good sharing or network effects, you don't have activation nailed down, you don't have a good onboarding flow, it's not intuitive, like, you won't have PLG. It won't happen.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense of why you'll see an exec team here that have this idea of doing a free trial, and they're thinking, this is it. This is going to kill. Like, as soon as we unlock free trial, people are going to see the value of the product, and it's up and to the right for us, baby. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I've been on multiple product teams where they introduced a free trial only to roll it back because it did not solve the problem they thought they were solved. Actually, sometimes things got worse.
Yes.
Because people got in the product and thought, oh, this isn't awesome, so I'm not going to pay for it. Once you pay for it, you're like, I kind of want to make this thing work. Mm-hmm. But I think it makes sense to really just clarify that that's not, it's one tool in a wide array of tools you can do to make your company product led.
Yes.
You, when I sat in on your talk at the PMA Summit in SF, I think that one of the most helpful things that you talked about was this idea of PLG existing on a spectrum, mm-hmm. and that the goal maybe isn't to just become PLG overnight, like a light switch, but to move down the spectrum. So could you kind of walk us through a spectrum of taking someone from sales led all the way through to sales led through and through to like a fully product led motion? Could you move kind of what's on that spectrum?
Yeah. So what a lot of B2B is used to on the total opposite end, where you're just sales led, you have no product led motion whatsoever. That means that you come to a website or whatever it may be, you fill out a form saying, I want to talk to sales. You go talk to sales, and this is the first time you're viewing a product. Usually it's on the first or second call where they walk through a demo, and outside of screenshots that you see variously, and they're usually more mock-ups than screenshots, right? On the website, this is the first time you're really seeing the product in action and seeing what it can do and all of this kind of stuff. And you're not playing with it yourself. You are watching a salesperson kind of walk through this motion. Then you get to the end, you buy the software, you talk with the CSM, and they get you implemented and onboarded. And this is now the first time that you've interacted with the product. That is the full sales-led model. If you take like one step towards PLG, this could look like, you know, doing either a free trial that's manually provisioned, which means that essentially how we think about free trials is like auto provisioning, meaning I can come in, I create an account, I can do all of these things on my own. However, with manual provisioning, there's a free like demo platform essentially that's sort of like the bare bones of what it is, but you can't get onto it and create an account yourself. A product person has to go, they have to manually add you in. This is not scalable, by the way, but it's a great way to like test this model a little bit. Let you in, and you can only work on it for like a week, and then it closes you out and you can't do anything else. You have to go talk to sales, right? That could be one baby step. Another baby step could be having a demo walkthrough on your website. This is so helpful for not only conversion over to sales, talking to sales, but also for getting the deal done, especially if your competitors don't have it. Walking through and giving someone a taste of what the product looks like, how to move through it, what the value is in different areas. What's great about a walkthrough is you can have messaging and positioning along with the product. Whereas if someone's just going through it on their own, especially without any like guides, tours, whatever, like it's just the product. So it's a great like combination of product and messaging. Then you can kind of get over into some of the auto provisioning stuff, like a free trial, which is where you can go on the website and create an account without talking to anybody from sales. But maybe the trial ends and you have to go talk to sales. Or maybe if they're, you know, have some sort of self-serve billing, maybe you could swipe your credit card and, you know, continue on in the trial. But the trial ends and cuts you out of the product if you don't either talk to sales or swipe your credit card. My favorite, if we lean all the way on the PLG spectrum towards product, is reverse trial, which is essentially you come in on a trial and let's say you have three tiers. So you'd come on the third tier and you'd have access to everything in the platform for 2 weeks, whatever your trial is. At the end of 2 weeks, instead of like with the trial, you just get booted. You either have to talk to sales or swipe your credit card. You get downgraded if you are not going to upgrade on your own. You get downgraded to a freemium product. So you're technically a freemium. You have a freemium model, but the way that you put users into the platform is on a trial of a upgraded version. And then instead of kicking them out altogether, if they don't choose to move forward, you have a freemium base tier, always free, that they fall back on. And then you can kind of oscillate. There's some, you know, cool growth stuff you can do to oscillate between the two. Anyway, I could talk about this forever, but yes, that's kind of the spectrum of things, in a simplified form.
No, that's super helpful, particularly that last point about starting at whatever you're starting that trial at whatever is the top tier of your product or whatever makes sense for that particular, for the most of your customers to have them have full access and then work back down into the freemium. Because I feel like a lot of times people will start with the freemium and then you'll just see a lot of feature gates.
Yeah,
and it's like, oh, it'd be cool. Wouldn't it be cool if you could do this? It's got a little grayed out lock or something, or like a little yellow sparkle, like upgrade today.
Yeah.
And I do think it is, in my mind, most fully product led to let them experience the whole thing as they would if they pay for it and then back down. Mm-hmm. And then say, if they're not ready, you can still talk to them. You know, you still have a reason to talk to them because they still have a freemium account. Like, it's not like they have disappeared into the void. If, let's go back to the hypothetical fully sales-led motion. Mm-hmm. If you could pick one or two, say you're talking to a PMM who is like, I really want to move us more product-led. What questions would you ask them to try to figure out what the right first step would be? Because I think it would be easy just to kind of like go out and be like, oh, I'm going to replicate whatever the best PLG people have done or try to advocate for it. But obviously, depending on the product, depending on its price point, what they sell, the complexity, the integrations, like it's not as simple as just like go click up it, you know, or go do something like that. Go loom it. And so what kind of questions would you ask if I come to you and I'm like, hey, Madison, I really want to move Classy to more of a PLG model and I'm not really sure where to start. What are the questions you would ask?
Well, the first thing I would say before I even ask any questions is like, move so slow. Like that seems so counterintuitive, especially if you're a startup, but move slow or it will fail. I can promise you. This is coming from like learning this experience the hard way, but I would say the questions that I would ask would probably be first, what data do you have? Because in order to be PLG in any capacity, even if you're only doing, you know, small things on this spectrum, you have to have data to inform it. It's not about just implementing something. And so I would say make sure you have data and pick some kind of hypotheses to base everything around. So the questions I would probably ask that person is like, what's the point of PLG? Is it just because you think you should? We have to put more meat to that, right? Let's build a business case for this a little bit more. Cause I agree with you and your gut is usually right about these things because again, we make intuitive decisions. So you're probably onto something, but we need to create a case around this a little bit more in order to like have some meat behind this. So I would probably ask questions around like, what's the goal? Is the goal just to test this model? Is the goal to increase sales pipeline velocity? Is the goal to, you know, whatever it is? I would ask them questions about a particular segment, right? What segment do you think would operate best with this? If you're selling a enterprise software and you're selling $1 million plus ACV deals, I would get really granular about your segment because if you are mostly talking with C-suite executives, they're not going to give two, you know what, about having a free trial because they're not in the platform. So you have to make sure that your sales process is oriented around a champion who is a big part of the deal cycle. And if they're not, then I would probably say, let's focus somewhere else for right now. I'd probably also ask questions around sort of like the product team's data in general. What I have found working at B2B companies is that the product org sometimes becomes a little bit more like project managers out instead of product managers. And what I mean by that is like they'll just build features and ship them. And then they just go into the void and they're sort of like marketing, do something with it, sales, here it is, it's ready to go. And they don't really take full owner. This is why I like PLG so much. The product org is forced to take ownership over, are people using this? If not, let's get people to use it. Why aren't they using it? Like, is this equating to having retention in the platform as a whole? Those things are important because you have to know what to either show in like a walkthrough demo on your website, or if you're having some sort of like manually provisioned self-trial or self-serve free trial, you have to know what to put in there. This isn't just like open the gates to whatever you want. You have to know exactly what to lead people towards. So I would work from scratch to be like, we need to go figure out what works and what doesn't. And we need to have a goal here. And then you can go and do this motion, or at least baby step towards it, right? Again, this is not, it will take a year plus. I want to like make sure everybody's understanding this. To move from sales led and to incorporate PLG, it's not moving away from sales led, it's just incorporating a self-serve where you can create an account, get value on your own, and convert with a credit card on your own. It will take a year plus to do this. If you do it right, you can just, you know, haphazardly, but it will take a year. It's a good investment, but it will take a year. So the baby steps are, I think, what's more reasonable for a lot of folks to kind of wrap their head around.
Yeah, that's super helpful. It just, even that idea of starting with the data you actually have, like what's the actual state of affairs with how our customers engage with the product? Are our customers, are we losing deals because customers aren't seeing the product? Are we having a hard time booking demos because they haven't seen it and we're trying to drive that velocity? Starting there is so helpful. I remember I worked on a team where they were really experimenting with trials and how long a free trial could run. And we had a problem that even amongst our paid customers, it was a knowledge product. So it had a series of videos associated with it. And people weren't starting the first video. Like they would pay us for it. And then they just like, wouldn't even come back. We're like, we have a problem that a trial is not going to fix because people aren't even using this thing. Yep. And if someone, and then we had on the opposite of the spectrum, people would trial and then they would just binge all the content in the 7-day trial and be like, peace. So there's some stuff foundationally that was broken, and getting clear on that before trying to just PLG it feels like a really helpful starting point.
Yep. And I also say too, you can't forget your trusty, like, customer facing organization. Like, talk to CSMs. They're talking with customers all the time. They see when people are understanding and really getting it. So leverage people inside of the org who talk with customers all the time about the product. And they can be very, very, very valuable data sets, even if you don't have like infrastructure data in place on the product side.
Well, Madison, first off, thank you for coming on the show. I feel like I could spend another hour unpacking this stuff and just chatting with you because you're delightful and very helpful. If people want to keep up with you and what you're up to, where can they find you?
LinkedIn is my number one hub. I have free resources that I post weekly. I also have some fun little things in my, featured section. I'll just put some tidbits there, some free takeaways, some cool things to help people. So LinkedIn, of course, and reach out. DM, comment, whatever. LinkedIn's my hub.
Yeah. I'm not going to offer up resume reviews on your behalf. Because
I'm going to get a whole influx of resumes. Yeah.
So I heard Colin say that you, but amazing. Yeah, I will to double click that. Madison's an amazing follow. So do yourself a favor. Again, thank you. Would love to do this again soon.
Yes. Thanks so much. I had so much fun.
For everyone still tuned in, thanks so much for listening, and if you enjoyed the podcast, please help us spread the word to other product marketers. Before we leave you to get on with your day, if you want to get involved, here are a few ways you can. If you're a product marketer and you want to come on the show and speak about your day, a specific topic, or your role in general, that's one option. If you want to flex your podcast hosting skills, being a guest host is another. And finally, if you or your company want to sponsor an episode, there's a third. Thanks again and have a great morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are.